Think of all the things William Shakespeare brought to the English language, the characters, the body of work, the quotes, the insults. The insults? Oh, yes. Mr. Shakespeare put quite a few choice insults into his plays, and many people have remarked upon the insults, collected them, and put them out there for the rest of the world to use. One of them is Barry Craft, author of a book called Shakespeare Insult Generator. If the name Barry Craft sounds familiar to you, he's a longtime actor, dramaturg, and teacher in the works of Shakespeare. He's acted in more than 100 parts in every one of Shakespeare's plays. He's been with the Oregon Shakespeare Festival for 20 seasons. This is actually a reworking of his earlier book on Shakespeare insults. The 1998 version was called Thy Father is a Gore-Bellied Codpiece, and he's also the author of another book called After Dinner Shakespeare. Barry Craft, an honor to have you here on the Jefferson Exchange.
Thank you very much, Jeff.
This apparently is quite an industry now. You just mentioned before we started that you don't go online, but there are Shakespeare insult generators online. Yours is a handheld device, as it were.
Yes, fits very well into one hand.
So why this book now?
Well, what do we mean by now? We are getting very close to April 23rd, which most people think is the birthday of Shakespeare. It's not. The 23rd is St. George's Day, the patron saint of England, and it's the day Shakespeare died. So it'd be very convenient for him to have been born on that day, but we don't really know. I opt for the 22nd. So when we come to April 22nd or 23rd, we are 450 years since the birth of Shakespeare, and there's going to be a bit of to-do, and this is part of the to-do.
And so Shakespeare, you know, there's truly the gift that keeps on giving here. I mean, and what in particular makes the insults so timeless?
I think people like to insult each other in a creative and verbally heavy way. At least I hope so. We hope that the book will take off. And it's a nice way to insult someone without repercussions. You see, I'm just quoting Shakespeare. And Shakespeare was very deep into using these insulting words. In the preface, I mentioned that we use what are called nonce words, words that are created for the occasion that Shakespeare would use just once and once only. And that's about 25% of everything that he wrote was a nonce word. And also, instead of the single word, and I can't say them, I'm sure, on public radio that we have today, he had many multi-syllabic words, which were marvelous, that he would, again, just create for the occasion and not use again. And we have also in this book an indication that Shakespeare might have been the first user of the word. Certainly the first time it's found in print. Whether he heard it in a bar that night, we don't know. But and so there are very, very many of those. And those are also indicated by a little sign. And you have a definition on the back of each page.
We should let the audience understand how the book is structured. The Shakespeare Insult Generator, once you get past the preface and the introduction, is really more like three decks of cards in a spiral binding. And you have the ability then to flip the cards over, and so you can – so the top one is – the top two are adjectives,
yes.
Is that right? All right. So, and then the bottom one is a noun. So, for example, you'll flip over and get at random heinous, bald-pated braggart. Or you could change that to, if you flip over more cards, heinous, bald-pated coxcomb, or change the middle adjective to heinous, lily-livered coxcomb. You know, you get the idea here. So there's just all sorts of combinations available here. How did you hit upon the idea of making it like this, like a flip book?
Well, that was actually Chronicle Books who said the earlier one was like that too. But I think it's wonderful. They realized how many different insults you could have. I think they say it's 150,000 by rearranging these pages. And it's got a nice little spiral binding. And it looks pretty firm. It's not going to fall apart with just a few usages. And I think that was their idea.
Let's talk about the nonce words, though, that you mentioned. I mean, the things that Shakespeare would use that he never used again.
Yes.
But was that just a fit iambic pentameter?
Was
no. Was it just because it fit a certain set of pronunciations that sounded good?
The amazing thing about Nant's words, if you take his entire vocabulary, and it's something like 21,000 words, a full quarter of those words were used once and once only. He discarded them after a single usage. And the dictionary definition, my favorite one-volume dictionary, Chambers, says a Nant's word is occurring, adopted, or coined for a particular occasion only. And why he chose to do this, I don't know. But it's one of the reasons I think that he is so long-lived, his usage of language.
Give us the context of Shakespeare's times. I mean, was insulting people an art? Was it a profession? I mean, were there people who were, like, hired insult experts?
Well, I don't know about Shakespeare's time, but an introduction to the book says beforehand that when the Celts or Celts, call it what you will, were ready to have a fight with a warring clan, they would have an official insulter come out and throw terrible words at the opposing army. And when both of them had done this enough, everybody was angry enough to actually fight. But another way of looking at insults is that it gets rid of the actual need to cause physical mayhem on someone else. You can, and I've seen this in the streets of San Francisco late at night, people screaming at each other back and forth, and it doesn't come to fisticuffs or shooting or anything like that. Apparently, it's all dissipated through the verbal.
All right. Much more to talk about with Barry Craft. His book is Shakespeare Insult Generator, but his knowledge extends far beyond the insults. We have a lot to talk about with Barry Craft about Shakespeare and language, and this is a discussion you can join. Please feel free to do so. We'll be back from the break with Barry Craft and you in a minute five. Back on the Jefferson Exchange on Jefferson Public Radio's News and Information Service, I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Our guest today is Barry Craft, longtime worker bee, I guess we'll call him, at the Oregon Shakespeare Festival, as dramaturg and actor. Just dramaturg this year, he is the dramaturg for The Tempest, which opens the Oregon Shakespeare Festival season in preview Friday night at the Angus Bomer Theater in Ashland. We're talking more about the general concept of Shakespeare and the language of Shakespeare. Barry has certainly given us the tip of the iceberg with a new book called Shakespeare Insult Generator, which gives you a chance to come up with some really choice insults with a choice of two adjectives and a noun then by using the flip cards contained within this book. You can join our discussion on the exchange about Shakespeare and his language and his impact on society. 800-838-3760, anywhere in the listening area. In the Rogue Valley, 541-552-6782. By email, jx@jeffnet.org. I've just talked about you being dramaturg at The Tempest. For the folks who don't know what that term is, and it seems like it's a somewhat difficult one to get across, what does a dramaturg do? And it is turg with a G, I want to point out.
I think there's a debate about that, too, as well as everything else about a dramaturg. It's not an English word. It's a German word, and I think it was the German playwright Lessing who in the late 1700s was connected to the Hamburg Theater, and he would write notes about the plays and distribute them to the actors and directors who would throw them into the wastebasket, and he would collect them and then publish them. It's a dramaturg. Some dictionaries define it as a playwright. I'm not a playwright. Or as a person who chooses the season. And I'm not a person who chooses the season either. I am a person who is deeply dyed in Shakespeare and Shakespeareana, and I've done this all my life. So I'm called on to kind of give a little expertise on the language, the background, the usage, the syntax. Practically anything a director wants me to do, I do. Even occasional little rewriting I will do. So as a dramaturg with The Tempest this year, I met with Tony Tacconi in spring of last year, and we spent 9 days going over the text, what changes he thought needed to be made for the production we made, and we just explored everything, the characters, the syntax, the background, and then that led to our script, and which has been, of course, altered since then once we get into rehearsal.
So how different is this version of The Tempest just in text from what is out there available?
As far as the words are concerned, it's exactly the same, except for what is called the mask scene, where there are three goddesses, Juno, Iris, and Ceres, who come down to bless young Ferdinand and Miranda. Here, there are buto dancers who do something which is very different. There had been some discussion whether or not Shakespeare actually wrote that mask scene. It came at the end of his career when masks were very popular, and there's kind of a tradition of putting something creative and different in that Act 4, Scene 1 mask scene.
Are there any choice insults in The Tempest, or is it a little more serious than that?
I think there are. When you hear Prospero talk to Caliban, his servant, slave, some very harsh things said. Abhorred slave, which any prince of goodness wilt not take, being capable of all evil. Though, of course, that isn't really an insult, I suppose. It's Prospero's way of seeing who Caliban is. And we may see Caliban differently, but... There may be some choice ones, but they don't come to mind right now.
All right. The scene you do provide in Shakespeare Insult Generator from King Lear, Kent insulting Oswald.
Yes.
Is this a shining star of
Shakespeare?
This is
the shining star. You want to read that, Jeffrey? That is magnificent.
Oh, I'd like you to read it.
Oh, well, all right.
There you go. Right there on the right page.
Oswald, who is a bit of a sycophant and who has been very difficult to King Lear, and this has bothered Kent, who is now disguised as Caius. And when they meet, Oswald doesn't recognize Kent. It's in the dark. And Oswald says, I know thee not. And Kent says, fellow, I know thee. What dost thou know me for? And here comes the greatest pearl of all of Shakespeare's insults. What dost thou know me for? A knave, a rascal, an eater of broken meats, a base, proud, shallow, beggarly, three-suited, 100-pound, filthy, worsted-stalking knave, a lily-livered, action-taking, whoreson, glass-gazing, super-serviceable, finical rogue, one trunk-inheriting slave, one that would be a bawd in the way of good service, and art nothing but the composition of a knave, beggar, coward, pander, and the son and heir of a mongrel bitch. Isn't that so much better than you are a son of a bitch?
It really
You're son and heir of a mongrel bitch.
It really does take things to new heights. Barry Craft reading from King Lear, Kent insulting Oswald. We're talking about the Shakespeare Insult Generator, his book, but also more broadly about Shakespeare and language. Did Shakespeare take insulting then to new heights? I mean, is this a place where insulting had never gone as far as we can tell?
Maybe new depths would be a better word than new heights. He took almost all aspects of language to a different plane. There was, of course, an age with plenty of litigation. Shakespeare himself, what we know about his life, was engaged in lawsuits of all kinds. And it was very dangerous for a playwright to say something incorrect, whether it had to do with religion or the government. There was one playwright, I forget the name, who had his hand chopped off, the one that was writing whatever the scurrilous thing he had to say about the government. And Ben Jonson went to jail, and there were duels, and Christopher Marlowe was slain, perhaps because of some altercation like this. So I think you had to be careful.
All right, let's take a call here. Grab your headphones. We'll take this call from Richard in Ashland. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange. We're talking to Barry Craft about Shakespeare and language and insults. Go ahead, Richard.
Yeah, I've known Mr. Craft for over 30 years. And I'll start off by just saying that he's one of the most astute, graceful, talented, knowledgeable actor, dramaturg, gadflies I've ever had the pleasure of knowing. And I'd like to relate an incident that happened where he insulted me on stage, and I think he did it improvising in iambic pentameter when he referred to me as a hedgehog or a
mad badger, perhaps?
A mad badger. Yes, and he had me laughing so hard that I tripped, falling up a flight of stairs. I was laughing so hard at this improvisational moment. I was wondering if he could repeat that insult that he, I think it was an insult, that he referred to at that moment.
So insult that led to injury.
Yes.
All right, thanks.
The voice is Richard Elmore, who is going to be playing Stefano in our production of The Tempest this year, and I have known him since our first season here in 1980. He's a dear, dear friend and a marvelous actor, and he plays Stefano to the hilt. The incident he's referring to had to do with memory lapse, which happens to all actors at all times. It has nothing to do with age. We forget things all the time. And
go up, as the expression goes, yes.
To go up. Bop. And Richard was playing the part of Master Page, and I was doing the jealous Master Ford in The Merry Wives of Windsor. And when we exited the stage, we actually, going up, we went up the stairs, and I couldn't remember what the exit line was. And it wasn't, I think, directed to Richard, but I said, ye gods, it doth make me furious as a mad badger. And as I walked off, I turned back and he wasn't following me. He had collapsed on the staircase, lost in laughter. And so we've thrown this back and forth to each other. He showed me a lapel pin when we were in Coriolanus. He sprung it on me on stage with a picture of a badger, and I almost lost it on stage. I guess we shouldn't be saying these things. We don't want too much play in plays, I suppose.
Don't want the audience to know some of the secrets that go on up there, but there are quite a few. Thanks for that, Richard. Appreciate it. Which brings up a question. You've probably heard the same story, too, but the story of two great actors, and I don't remember who they were. I don't remember where the story came from. On stage doing Shakespeare, and one of them wandered off from Hamlet off into some other great play and was doing, and the other actor went with him, knew enough of the text from that play, and then finally guided them both back into what they should have been doing in the first place. Have you heard that story?
I've been part of that story. When I was in the Old Globe at San Diego, Ellis Rabb, who was playing Benedick, and I was doing Claudio, Benedick didn't wander off, but he didn't come on. And so I was left with John Frederick Jones ad-libbing, and finally I walked off stage and said, I will seek Signor Benedick, which of course isn't Shakespeare, but better seek him or the play stops. Walked off, and there he was walking, kind of mumbling to himself up and down. I said, Ellis, you're on. Oh, he said, perfectly calmly, walked on and picked up the scene. But maybe what you refer... Also, Daniel Day-Lewis, when he played Hamlet a number of years ago, a number of decades ago, it was shortly after his father... I think it was C. Day-Lewis, the poet, had died, and he was distraught totally. And he's playing Hamlet, a character with a lost father. And he apparently identified the actor playing the ghost of his father, the elder Hamlet, and he couldn't take it anymore, and he just left. And I had two friends, Kevin and Lisa, who were in the audience that night, and the stage manager came out and said, there will be a stop here, a pause. And the understudy came out and did perfect, you know, word perfect and finished it. My favorite story, though, about this, and I wasn't quite born then. It was in the late 1700s. The father of Edwin Booth and John Wilkes Booth, Junius Brutus Booth, was a madman and an alcoholic and a great Shakespearean actor. And
you make it sound like those three things always come together.
Well, I don't know always, but you certainly find a good combination of those. At least I have in my theatrical experience. But he was playing Richard III, and he was supposed to be killed by Richmond, the young, you know, upstart. And they're dueling. They had the blocking of fighting, and he kept fighting. And Richmond said, "Die! It's time to die." And Junius Brutus, breaking out of character, said, "Die, no, damn you, you die." And he kept sword fighting the poor actor playing Richmond completely off the stage. That isn't allowed anymore, unfortunately. We're cabin cribbed and confined these days by rules.
Yeah, well, they're good rules, it sounds like, because of incidents such as that one.
Well, that's memorable, you have to admit.
Absolutely. Barry Craft is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. We're talking about Shakespeare and language, and partly through the context of his reworked book called Shakespeare Insult Generator. It allows you to mix and match more than 150,000 insults in the bard's own words, adjective, adjective, noun, in three different decks. Join us on the Jefferson Exchange to talk about insults, or more broadly about Shakespeare and language and what he did with that. 800-838-3760, anywhere in the listening area. In the Rogue Valley, 541-552-6782. Email address is jx@jeffnet.org. You mentioned the marks in the book, indicating the nonce words and the first uses of words. Now, some are marked for both.
Yes. It would be a word that was used just once and once only, and it is a word that we find only, or rather first, in Shakespeare. We'd like to think that Shakespeare created those words. Recently, with computer studies, we found a lot of obscure Elizabethan writers, not necessarily playwrights or poets, but even letter writers, used some of these words before Shakespeare. So that number, which at one time was like 1,600 words that Shakespeare created or first used has dwindled down to about 700 or 800 now. But I feel sure that many of those were invented by Shakespeare.
Well, some of these words, for example, you do provide definitions on the back of each of the cards in the book for what the word means. So fascinarius was just one example I pulled out. How do you know it means extremely wicked and vile?
Oh, that's a great word. Well, if there's no, I guess a dictionary after they found the word appears will decide, but you can decide in context how it is used in the scene by what character against what character, and that helps us. But there are a number of words in Shakespeare that we have no idea what they mean, and some of his nonce words, I don't have a list of them here, that never caught on. They were just obsolete at the time, and they're now, you know, nobody knows them.
Interesting. So he might have been, he was the first person to use them and might have been the last person as well.
Yes.
Interesting. So all right, so let's go there, though, and get into this realm of the Shakespeare discussion. I mean, how could one guy be so prolific and so inventive all at once?
Well, probably better than a committee could. I think usually it's one guy who does such things. But holding on to that idea about understanding Shakespeare, I'd love to read this little section, if I have time, of John Dryden's. John Dryden was the poet laureate, died in 1700, and was the foremost man of letters and a playwright of his time. Nobody reads him today, but he thought that so much of Shakespeare was obscure. He rewrote the plays. The Tempest he rewrote as The Island, added new characters, tried to make the words understood. And this is what Dryden says way back in 1679. He says, "It must be allowed to the present age that the tongue in general is so much refined since Shakespeare's time that many of his words and more of his phrases are scarce intelligible. And of those which we understand, some are ungrammatical, others coarse, and his whole style is so pestered with figurative expressions that it is as affected as it is obscure. He often obscures his meaning by his words and sometimes makes it unintelligible." You think that would be the end of Shakespeare, 1679, but new generations have found new meanings, and especially the social context, the wonderful stories that Shakespeare is telling, and have gone back to Shakespeare's words and don't feel the need to make him modern.
Was there a long dry spell for Shakespeare? Were there decades or centuries in which people didn't use much of Shakespeare's material?
Absolutely. In fact, all the founding fathers of this country, including Thomas Jefferson, if they saw Shakespeare, they would not see, like King Lear, there's an example. It was considered just wrong to have Cordelia die at the end and Lear die. So a playwright, Nahum Tate, made a happy ending where Lear goes off to an old age home with Gloucester, who's also alive, and Cordelia marries Edgar, and everything is happy. That held the stage for about 150 years. 150 years, all during the time of the founding of this country, for instance. So if you wanted your Shakespeare, you'd have to read it. If you saw, experienced a production, you'd be getting something very, very different.
Well, so that really speaks to the what each society expected. I remember hearing a story about Henrik Ibsen's A Doll's House and the fact that in the German production of it, Nora has to go back and look at the children and decide, no, I can't leave. Because it was just too shocking in Germany at that time to consider a woman leaving her husband and children behind.
That's great. No. We make Shakespeare mean what we want him to mean. And that's part of his longevity, I think.
Let's. I want to come back to the insults for just a few minutes here. We have to take a break fairly soon. You do a riff on the F word in your introduction here. And, of course, it's a word we can't say on the radio. But it may not be as inventive. Certainly has its pleasures, I guess, when you're using it. You have to concede that much, don't you?
Yes, yes. Playwrights like David Mamet use that single word over and over like a hammer, just driving that insult in. And it does have a powerful effect. There's no question. We call it the F word, you know, for that very reason. But when Shakespeare, like the section I read of Kent insulting Oswald, it is so much richer. It's just, it's more of a joy. It's not just a hammer on your head, but an invitation to let your imagination wander.
Is there a disclaimer here, as in don't use this book if you think it might lead to an actual fist fight?
Well, that's great, Jeffrey. No, I do write at the end, and I learned this in from a couple of actors who went on to found South Coast Repertory Theater. This is back in the early 60s, who taught me how to hurl insults while moving. It said, finally, this is from the conclusion of the introduction, these words are to be used, not just savored silently. Articulation, enunciation, and projection are indispensable. Practicing in the shower is a good start. However, the ultimate test is to hurl these insults from the open window of your rapidly accelerating automobile and have them clearly heard by all those mammering, leaden-footed ox heads on the sidewalk. And that way, there's no repercussions if you're in this moving vehicle as you're yelling them out the window.
All right, so consider yourself, as if you're listening, as a cold-blooded, lust-breathed fleshmonger. That's what my book turned to just now. Come back on the Jefferson Exchange with Barry Craft, and you can join our conversation when we return in a minute 10. Final segment on today's Jefferson Exchange. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Our guest is Barry Craft, 20 seasons at the Oregon Shakespeare Festival as actor and dramaturg. He is the dramaturg for the first show that will preview to the public at the Shakespeare Festival this season. Friday night, The Tempest goes up in Angus Bohmer Theater. But he's here to talk about Shakespeare more generally and more specifically about a work of his own called Shakespeare Insult Generator, a book containing essentially three decks of cards. Adjective, adjective, noun, and you get to flip through the book and decide which of the great choice insults that Shakespeare used over time that you can get to. So a little flipping here leads us to an overgorged loggerheaded blockhead. I mean, just think about how much more resonant that is than "you dumb jerk" or something like that. Join us on the Exchange as we talk about not just Shakespeare insults, but Shakespeare and language more generally. Our phone number is 800-838-3760, anywhere in the listening area. In the Rogue Valley, 541-552-6782, and by email, jx@jeffnet.org. Barry, I want to get into you and the attraction you had to Shakespeare's work in the first place. This has been a lifelong attraction. And what started it all?
Terror. My mother took me to see Laurence Olivier's Hamlet, the 1948 film. And I remember when The Ghost came out, Olivier had actually put Vaseline on the front of the lens. So I had never seen anything like that. And I was terrified watching that ghost. But I also got imprinted with Hamlet. And I thought to myself, someday I want to play Hamlet. At a ripe age of 12, like 4 years later, I didn't play Hamlet. I had one of the smallest roles in the play, the prologue to the play within the play, when John Carradine came through Laguna Beach, the father of the Carradine sons, who are very old now. One of them is. And so the call went forth to have local people hold spears or play small roles. And I got the role after audition, and I watched John Carradine. I guess today he would be called Hammy. Mm-hmm. You know, he would sit on a chair before the to be or not to be soliloquy, and a pin spot would light up his face, and he'd slowly, to be or not to be. That sort of business. But when you're 12 years old, you're not much of a critic. And I found it fascinating. And any 12-year-old around something that he or she loves will memorize it, you know, whether it's songs or the workings of the internal combustion machine. With me, it was Shakespeare. So I had Shakespeare all through my head at 12 years old, as Hamlet in particular, and I kept reading. And then 10 years later at the Colorado Shakespeare Festival at age 22, I got to play the Prince of Denmark in a very fine production. And they said, well, weren't you kind of young at 22 to play it? I said, well, not only is that Hamlet's age, but I had spent 10 years preparing for the role.
Had you been off book for 10 years?
just about.
I assume you have worked, though, in the work of other playwrights, other plays.
I mean,
does anybody else even come close in your mind to Shakespeare?
Well, the one that sticks in my mind is Tom Stoppard. I think his plays are fantastic. They're verbally intricate. They have multiple meanings. And most recently, Bill Kane, who wrote Equivocation about Shakespeare, which was done at OSF, I think, 3 years ago. I was extremely fortunate to work as the dramaturg on that production, too. And that is a delight as well. I still like George Bernard Shaw. I love language-heavy plays. They're my favorites.
Good stuff. Let's take a call from Connie and Eugene. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange. We're talking to Shakespeare actor and dramaturg Barry Kraft.
Sorry, I can't get over that phrase. Anyway, I'm just curious with, you know, you've indicated the enormous number and tremendous variety of the insults, and has been for decades or centuries such a controversy, you know, who was Shakespeare, who wrote Shakespeare or whatever. Do the insults provide any specific information about that might veer one way or the other, and have they been used to say, you know, this Marlowe wrote it or whoever wrote it? Or so I'd just like to find out more about that.
Well, it's hard. That's a good question. We'd like to be able to say, ah, there's the signature of the man behind the work. But with Shakespeare, obviously he had a lot of venom in his system or knew about it to use them, whether they came out in a literary form and not as his person is concerned, we don't know. But some of the most famous quotations, it's not famous, but good wine be a good familiar creature if it be well used. That's a wonderful statement, but it's said by a total villain, Iago, who's trying to get poor Michael Cassio drunk and lose his position. And Polonius, to thine own self be true. And he's kind of a windbag. So it's hard to say. I think that's the brilliance of a writer like, if there is another writer like Shakespeare, is to be a chameleon, to invest in whatever character he or she is writing and make you believe that that is autobiographical. This has been the huge question, you know. But I believe it was the man from Stratford, William Shakespeare, who did write these works.
Connie, thanks for that call. You were talking about the birth date of Shakespeare not being certain. Is it simply because no birth records are kept, but
no
baptism
birth,
records were?
There were baptism records, and he was baptized on April 26th. And a lot of people say, oh, it would be 2, 3, or 4 days before that that Shakespeare was born. How nice to have him born on April 23rd, St. George's Day, the day he died, to write all of those wonderful works in 24 hours. But I feel that it was the 22nd he was born, because I think it was his granddaughter chose that date to get married. And I like to think it was on Shakespeare's birthday. But we'll never know. And if you want to celebrate on the 23rd, be my guest. I celebrate on the 22nd.
Is there a burial place for Shakespeare? Do we know where his body lies?
His body lies, I think, in Stratford. And he wrote, maybe the last thing he wrote is a stone tablet says, good friend, for Jesus' sake forbear to dig the dust enclosed here. Blessed be the man that spares these stones, but cursed be he that moves my bones. Because he used to dig them up, just like in Hamlet, alas, poor Yorick, mm-hmm. And Shakespeare didn't want that happening to him. There have been theories that the true identity of Shakespeare is hidden down there in the coffin with Shakespeare, and I think there have been some drilling attempts, but I'm not very familiar with that. I don't think his bones have been moved, though, since 1623.
When you work as long and as deeply in Shakespeare as you have in your career, can you, or do you, have a favorite play or role?
Yes. If you had asked me this maybe 6 years ago, I would have said Hamlet. Hamlet has stayed with me in the character of Hamlet. But as I age, King Lear speaks more loudly and strongly to me. So I think I am right now evenly divided between Hamlet and Lear and moving on towards Lear.
What would you still like to do with Shakespeare's work that you haven't done yet? Is there still a Shakespeare bucket list for you?
Oh, good question. I've never done a Malvolio. I think that would be fun. Perhaps a Capulet in Romeo and Juliet. I find him a fascinating character. A King Lear, again, would be excellent. But it'd now be the older roles, ones that I haven't played, unless somebody wants to cast a 71-year-old man as Hamlet again, which might happen, and of course I would audition for it.
Right. Maybe you'll be at the top of anybody's list, I'm sure. Will you be reading the Declaration of Independence at Lithia Park on the 4th of July? And what got that started?
Well, I have loved Thomas Jefferson, fittingly said on Jefferson Public Radio, for decades. And some years back, I realized, maybe decades, that the 4th of July celebration did not include a reading of the Declaration of Independence. So I volunteered with the Chamber of Commerce, and for many years I read it. And last year, I got off book, so I memorized it in its 10-minute entirety. And I'm of divided mind. There are a couple of roles that I'm in consideration for at Shakespeare festivals out of Oregon. If I get those, I will do that. But if not, and I'm not doing something else on the 4th of July, I've already been asked to recite it again. And, of course, I would be happy to.
What is Thomas Jefferson, you told me before we got on the air, made some references to Shakespeare himself.
Yes, and I'd love to share a couple of these. Thomas Jefferson, myriad-minded man, would give, in letters, recommendations of books and so on for people to read. And this is something he said about fiction, and I just think it's excellent. Jefferson said in a 1771 letter, "Considering history as a moral exercise, her lessons would be too infrequent if confined to real life." Because we think of Shakespeare as a moral teacher. Many people still do. We get lessons from the plays. Back to Jefferson. "Of those recorded by historians, few incidents have been attended with such circumstances as to excite in any high degree this sympathetic emotion of virtue. We are therefore wisely framed to be as warmly interested for a fictitious as for a real personage. The field of imagination is thus laid open to our use, and lessons may be formed to illustrate and carry home to the heart every moral rule of life. Thus, a lively and lasting sense of filial duty is more effectually impressed on the mind of a son or daughter by reading King Lear than by all the dry volumes of ethics and divinity that ever were written."
So it sounds like what Jefferson is saying is it's better to see examples of life being lived by people, even if they are fictitious people, than to just get the, here's how you do it.
Yes,
the instructions on life.
And he says in fiction, it's a much wider range. We get too few of them in actual history. So I love that he opens up that area. If I have time, I'll read one more little thing.
Sure.
To another young person, he sent a list of books. And, I mean, books on history, books on English, books on America, criticism, rhetoric, oratory. I mean, the man had a phenomenal library. And here's what he says about, if I'm pronouncing it correct, belles lettres. It's French, and he spoke French much better than I do. But this is what he said to his young reader. He said, "Read the best of the poets, epic, didactic, dramatic, pastoral, lyric, etc. But among these, Shakespeare must be singled out by one who wishes to learn the full powers of the English language."
So in a sense, reading the Declaration of Independence on the 4th of July and doing all the other work you've done over the years on Shakespeare combines two of your favorite authors, it sounds
like. It sure does. It sure does.
Did Thomas Jefferson write any fiction of his own?
I don't think fiction, but this particular book, it's the Library of America, 1,600 pages of his writings. I was thumbing through it in Powell's last year, and I saw that he has a whole thing on poetry, a whole essay. It's actually a part of a letter saying how it should be said and where the cadences fall. And I had no idea that Jefferson ever concerned himself with such a matter, but he did. But I don't believe he wrote fiction. In fact, he asked young ladies not to read too much of it because they might get lost in it and not attend to the tasks of what we call the real world.
Really? And that was direction just to women?
Well, I think it's to his daughters. He wanted to, but he said that too. I know he has his failings, no question.
Just being honest here about that, right?
Yes. No,
although, you know, Jefferson, and I heard another discussion about this recently, that when you think about the people who did found this country, they certainly had an amazing depth of knowledge and wealth of knowledge. And then you think about the people who run the country politically today. Do you make any comparisons in your own mind?
Well, as Shakespeare said, comparisons are odorous. And well, it was actually not Shakespeare, one of his characters, Nick Bottom the Weaver, I think, or maybe Dogberry. But no, there's no question. But at that time, the founding, it staggers the mind to think of these people as architects and farmers and wine lovers and writers and great readers. We haven't seen anything like that since. You know the JFK story, don't you, about the Nobel Prize winners that he had in the White House for a dinner, and he turned to them, you know, this room filled with the best minds, and he said something to the effect of, "I doubt there has been a collection of such great minds in this room since the time when Thomas Jefferson dined alone."
Wow. That was quite a statement. Both for Jefferson and for the people who were in that room. Do you have a favorite, before we go, Shakespeare insult?
Oh, I can open the book at random, but I think most of the ones that were from Kent to Oswald in King Lear.
That was a classic moment you read for us before. But calling somebody a sneeping, self-glorious pin buttock.
Yes, that is fantastic, too. I think this book will have, you know, great joy. I mean, bring great joy to the spewer of the insults. How much joy will it bring to the recipient is another question. But it'll improve one's vocabulary immensely. And should there be repercussions by a teacher who didn't like that, all that student has to say, but it's Shakespeare.
Right. It's okay if I called him a super serviceable, tardy-gated rat catcher, because it's from Shakespeare. Barry Kraft, it's been a pleasure. Thanks so much for coming.
Thank you, Jeffrey.
The book is called Shakespeare Insult Generator from Chronicle Books. It's a pretty small thing. You might miss it on the shelves. It's about the size of your hand, but it's meant to be held there as you insult other people. And thanks again, Barry Kraft, for writing it and for joining us today. Tomorrow on the Jefferson Exchange at 8, we'll talk about the Oregon chub being delisted, the first fish to be removed from the endangered species list. We'll talk about environmental group concerns about the Wyden ONC timber bill. And then at 9 o'clock, we'll talk about drought in the American West, which obviously we are living through, some of us, right here, right now. That's all tomorrow on the Jefferson Exchange. Our producer is Charlotte Duran. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Please join us again tomorrow at 8 for another edition of the Jefferson Exchange here on the News and Information Service of Jefferson Public Radio. And have a great day.